From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Richard Rhodes won the 1988 National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for his history of the atomic bomb. On this edition of Fresh Air, Rhodes shares his own history with us, the story of being physically and emotionally abused by a step-parent. Jimmy Rainey was one of the first musicians to bring bebop to the guitar. Rainey is playing beautifully today, but he's losing his hearing. We'll talk about the impact that's having on his life and his music. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead examines the legacy of the late Art Blakey, and book critic John Leonard reviews Two States, One Nation. It's Günter Grass's collection of essays opposing German reunification. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A Bush administration source said today that Labor Secretary Elizabeth Dole will step down to become head of the American Red Cross. Dole is the highest-ranking woman in the Bush administration and would become the first of President Bush's cabinet members to resign. 14 Americans released from Iraq were flown to Amman, Jordan today, the largest such group freed in recent weeks. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
In the last few days, Iraq has gotten maximum propaganda mileage out of the fact that it's been dribbling out trapped foreign nationals whose governments have gone to Baghdad to negotiate for their release. Today's release coincided with a visit from the Iraqi American Foundation in Washington, D.C. It's not clear how those released were chosen. At least six were young people 21 or under. Two of them were sons of embassy personnel. One, 20-year-old Jared Scania from Fairfax, Virginia, had to leave his father behind in Baghdad, as did 21-year-old Craig Turley from Phoenix. Both had been held in Kuwait before being transferred to Baghdad. 36 Britons also left Iraq today with former Prime Minister Edward Heath. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
French officials are pleased about Baghdad's decision to free all French hostages held in Iraq and Kuwait, but they say the release won't change the government's position. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
An official at the French Foreign Ministry welcomed the Iraqi announcement, but he said Baghdad's decision will not change France's attitude in the Gulf crisis. He said France will continue to enforce the UN sanctions against Baghdad until Iraq withdraws from Kuwait. Baghdad is now holding more than 300 French people, including 67 at military and strategic sites. Their release is certain to be a relief for their families here. But if Iraq does free them, questions will be raised about what France gave in return. The French Foreign Ministry says no deals have been made, but the Defense Minister has said their release is the least Baghdad could do for France, which used to be Iraq's second supplier of arms. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Republican sources said today that Ohio Congressman Donald Lukens will resign rather than face new charges of sexual harassment. Lukens was to have appeared before the House Ethics Committee today to respond to charges that he sexually harassed a congressional employee. His testimony was later put off until tomorrow afternoon. Sources say that Republican leaders have been hoping to persuade Lukens to resign ever since he was convicted of contributing to the unruliness of a minor for having sex with a 16-year-old girl. Lukens was fined and sentenced to 30 days in jail for that conviction, but refused to resign while his appeal was pending. Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22 points to close at 2,494. Advances led declines by a margin of 8 to 7. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I sometimes think about how much I don't know about the people I interview. A couple of years ago, I interviewed Richard Rhodes. He had just won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for his book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. It was certainly a big subject, one that left no room for me to ask him about his own life. Well, now I've just read his memoir about growing up, and I've learned that he was mentally and physically tormented by his stepmother. His birth mother killed herself when Richard Rhodes was 13 months old. 10 years later, his father remarried, and for the next 2 years, Richard's stepmother starved and beat him and his older brother until they escaped to a boys' home in the country. Richard Rhodes decided to go public with his story to tell people what child abuse feels like from the inside. His memoir is called A Hole in the World. He's the author of 8 other books. I asked him why he felt it was the right time to finally tell his story.
I'm not sure, although I really finally got through what I think was the after effects of the child abuse really just about 4 or 5 years ago, when I finally decided that heavy drinking wasn't very productive and decided to stop one day and stopped. Met someone I didn't want to lose and gave that up. So I found myself really ready at 53 years of age to look back and tell the story.
You describe the years that you spent living with your stepmother, and it was about 2 years and 4 months, as the concentration camp of our stepmother years. I want you to read a short passage that will, I think, help set the tone of for what that was like.
I should just say we lived with my father, my brother, and I for a number of years until he remarried when I was 10, and that was when a period of very severe abuse began. This paragraph, I think, describes something of what it seemed. My brother Stan uses political terms to describe what happened to us across the next 2 years at our stepmother's hands. I went out to Idaho, where he lives, to disentomb these memories with him. He spoke of force and power and domination, of rebellion and uprisings. I'd never thought of our victimization that way before. For me, what happened was, first of all, existential. To manipulate and to tame us, to make us new men, our stepmother, we never did call her mother, nor did she ever even remotely deserve the name, self-righteously attacked our mental and bodily integrity. She tinkered sadistically with control worked out on the surface and the interior of our bodies. I don't believe she began with a calculated program of coercion, any more than the Nazis began with a calculated program beyond expulsion for the European Jews. The problem was to deal with them. But once they'd been stripped of their rights, everything became possible. Since we were children and had few rights in the first place, since our father was too cowardly to defend us from brutalization, everything became possible for her as well.
You found a photograph from one of the years that you were living with your stepmother, and you describe yourself as looking like an Auschwitz child. How did she deprive you of food? What were you allowed to eat when you lived with her?
She contrived to move us from the family table into our bedroom by saying our manners were terrible. And since she beat all sorts of other skills into us, I never understood why she couldn't beat good manners into us. In fact, that enabled her to feed us the way one feeds farm animals, to cook up a pot of black-eyed peas without salt or other seasoning and reheat it, burn it, and simply ladle. I came to understand what Dickens meant by the word gruel when I thought about what we'd been fed. We also had, as a kind of portable lunch, an occasional hard-boiled egg, which, strangely enough, was also burned. We were fed, in other words, the absolute minimum at the least possible cost to save money.
What were your parents eating at the same time?
Oh, pork chops, strawberries, the usual meals. We weren't poor. We weren't certainly that poor. We were a pretty much standard blue-collar family.
Now, your stepmother wouldn't let you take more than one bath a month.
We lived the second half of this period of time in a storefront. She had started a little dress shop, and I think that's where all the extra money was going to go. I think that's why she was saving money. There was no bathtub in the back of the storefront, and there was a wash tub, and that was used by my father and by my stepmother. But it was inconvenient to have to lug water and fill it up, so she simply didn't. And in the course of time, I came to be filthy dirty, so did my brother, although he managed to sneak in occasionally and sponge bathe. I was afraid to do that. I was afraid she'd catch me. Finally, we stank. Our clothes were rotting off our bodies. And one terrible day in school that I'll never forget, some of my classmates decided to see why I smelled so badly and tore my clothes off, and there I was revealed with these black armpits and black neck, and I fell to the ground, curled up into a fetal position and pretended I was invisible, which I'd learned to do. They finally went away.
Were you aware of how dirty and smelly you were at the time?
Surely, yes. I was deprived, but I certainly wasn't stupid. I knew what was happening to me.
I think one of the things that got to me the most of all the ways that your mother, stepmother, tormented and punished you was how she prevented you from using the bathroom at night. When she went to bed, you weren't allowed to use the toilet.
This sounds like something simple, but it was one of the more subtle and horrible of her tortures, because paradoxical intention is an interesting phenomenon. If you're told not to do something or you can't do something, you tend to react by needing to. As soon as I got in bed, I needed urgently to urinate, and there was no way to do that until the following morning. I lay in pain as my bladder filled, and the clamping that I was doing with my sphincters caused them to cramp. I finally devised a method. She liked to can things, so there were lots of mason jars around. I finally devised a method for using the jar to urinate at night and hiding it, and then hopefully getting it out of the house later.
It sounds like a really bad fairy tale, doesn't it, about the evil stepmother?
Really, really. Hansel and Gretel used to interest me a great deal, and I finally understood why. We had lived something of a similar world.
Richard Rhodes is my guest, and he won a National Book Award and a Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. His new book is a memoir about his childhood. It's called A Hole in the World. You know, you can't help but think, well, where was his father during all of this? And your father stood for it. Your father allowed this to happen to you and your brother.
My father stood by, and in so doing, actually encouraged it. Because if you stand by and do nothing when someone is doing evil, you encourage that evil by implication. I don't know why. It's only in the last few years that I've realized that he was culpable. I forgave, or not forgave him. I always thought of him as just another victim without realizing that he was a strong, full-sized adult man, not another little boy like my brother and me.
Would your stepmother verbally abuse him or physically intimidate
him? Oh,
yes,
yes, no, absolutely. There's no question that he was an abused adult. But I'm sorry, I think adults are responsible for children.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever their problems, I think adults are responsible for children.
Were there other adults that you could tell about this?
There were. I don't know. In fact, I don't even remember if we told it. Probably not. I think we were so thoroughly terrified that we didn't. There were other adults who recognized that we were in some sort of trouble. There was a teacher who would give us an extra dime to buy some milk at lunchtime, send us off to buy some for her so that we'd have enough to eat, because our school lunches were a couple slices of bread and a drop of jelly. The kindness of strangers is what allowed my brother and me to survive without any question. I keep telling people these days, it is absolutely crucial that you not be a bystander, that if you see something wrong with a child, that you do something about it. Even a small intervention makes a difference with a child.
What kind of position did your teachers take? They could tell that you were emaciated. They could see by the lunches that you brought that you weren't getting a lot of food from home. They could tell that you weren't bathing, whether it was because of your own mm-hmm. rebellion or your parents' refusal to let you have a bath. They could smell something was wrong.
That's right.
So did they ever intervene on your behalf?
No.
Or try to ask you what was wrong at home?
Well, let's see. I don't remember any questions about what was wrong at home, but the answer is no. No one intervened on our behalf. I think that's probably because in 1948, 1949, there was no mechanism of intervention. You know, that's very crucial. If you want to change something, you have to have a way to do it. And in those days, even more than today, the family was sacrosanct. Even after we were finally taken out of this situation, I talked to the social worker years later who handled our case, and she said we had a terrible dilemma. You had two parents, and we almost never took people out of homes and put them in some other situation when you had both parents intact and in one place, even with abuse. So there was no hotline in those days. There was no way to deal with the situation except perhaps to give some kindness to the child, which people did.
What did your brother, who was older than you, do to protect you?
My wonderful brother, Stanley, who was just a year and a half older, hardly in a position to do much protecting, looked after me as a little boy because we had no mother around and Dad was working 6 days a week. Later on, toward the end of this period of child abuse, he finally found a way to get us both out of there. By then, I was reading science fiction day and night and compulsively drawing rockets in tablets and fantasizing traveling to other planets as a way of escaping the one I was on. My brother had discovered that there are 12-foot storm sewers under cities, and under Kansas City in this case, and and had spent his summers down in them all day, running around under the city, pretending he was Jean Valjean. We were both ready for some sort of help and treatment, I think, by then. And one particular hot summer day, Stan returned from one of his trips to the grocery store and brought home some milk, which was, the carton was damaged by bouncing around in his basket of his bicycle. And my stepmother accused him of trying to poison her by putting something in this broken carton of milk and began beating him with a belt with brass studs on it. And that was more than he could take, and even though he realized he was risking far worse punishment, he ran away. He ran to his tunnels. He spent the day there trying to decide. He told me recently when we talked all this over, he tried to decide where on earth he could go, who would take him, and he couldn't think of anyone. And so he went to the police, and the police recognized that he'd just been beaten. They recognized that he was emaciated with hunger. We both gained about 30 pounds within 3 months after we were alleviated from this situation, and so decided to do something about it. Well, they put him in the local juvenile detention center because that was the only place available for children in beyond parental situations. He got beaten there by one of the inmates, but he through these 2 weeks while we were waiting for this case to come to before a judge, he kept insisting over and over again, "Don't leave my brother behind. He must go with me wherever you send us." Despite the fact that I was back at home now being well-fed, offered all those nice foods, and offered scout camp and so forth, as a way my stepmother was trying to set me up to testify on her behalf. And fortunately, the judge had the good sense to realize that my brother was right and removed us both from this situation, made us wards of the court, sent us to an absolutely wonderful institution, a boys' home outside of Independence, Missouri, that was a farm where we raised our own food, which was absolutely wonderful because we had enough to eat and more, and gave us ways to become empowered again after 2 years of terrible helplessness. We were in church and scouts and 4-H and FFA, and we grew up.
I want to talk with you about what life was like in the boys' home, but first let's take a short break. And my guest is writer Richard Rhodes. His new book is a memoir about his childhood. It's called A Hole in the World. Rhodes also won a National Book Award and a Pulitzer Prize for his book The Making of the Atomic Bomb. This is Fresh Air. Richard Rhodes is my guest, and he tells the absolutely harrowing story of his childhood in the new book, A Hole in the World. You were telling us about how you got into the Andrew Drum Institute for Boys in 1949. It was a farm. All the kids had to work on the farm. What was the philosophy there? What was the approach of the adults toward the children in the home?
We were there because we had all come one way or the other from broken homes. It was understood that the institution itself, in the will of the founder, Andrew Drum, was set up to take care of indigent children, indigent boys, to give them a home, to help them, as it were, work their way through high school. We went to high school half a day, came home and either worked on the farm in the afternoon or went to classes and studied vocational agriculture. I learned to butcher cattle. I learned to can foods. And all the other things that came, I learned about diseases of chickens and a lot of wonderful, odd things to know for a writer, I must say. It's always stood me in good stead.
I'm always interested in the ways that someone's hardships or weaknesses or, you know, problems as a child influences the adult that they became. And for you, I mean, it obviously had a really profound effect on you, but isn't one of the reasons why you started reading because you were retreating from the world of your family and escaping into books?
Yes, one of the boarding house owners, a woman named Mrs. Gernhardt, taught me to read when I was 4 years old, and I was delighted and wondrous about books. Books had always seemed a great way to escape into other worlds. At the time of the abuse, they became even more so. In fact, one of the most diabolic punishments my stepmother managed to think of was to tell us, my brother and I, that we had to spend our evenings not reading as a punishment for whatever infraction we might have made. She was going to enforce this for 6 months, and that would have been hell for me, really, at that time. So books were always important, perhaps too important. I read compulsively all through childhood. I'm not surprised that I found myself wanting to write later on. It was difficult to begin, though. I had so much rage. I felt so much anger that I truly was afraid that, if I let it out, it would destroy me or the world or both. It took some psychotherapy before I could really sit down and write. And not surprisingly, the first thing I wrote that was, I thought, very good was about hunting coyotes and cockfighting, violent episodes in themselves.
But not personal, not about you.
No, but, you know, all of my books, I've published, I think, 10 books now. And with the possible exception of Farm, last year's book, which is kind of a pastoral, all of my books have essentially been about the same theme, which is violence and its effects on human beings and how they survive it and whether there's any hope.
You know, you mentioned you went into therapy before you actually started writing. Can I ask what kind of therapy it was and how you think it helped you?
He was a good man from the manager clinic. That's where he trained. So it was kind of the manager style, which was rather eclectic, whatever worked. How he helped? When I went into therapy, I was somewhat suicidal, going through a bad marriage. I weighed 132 pounds. I'm 5 feet 10. I wasn't eating. I had so much anxiety that I couldn't eat, and I wasn't writing. It's as if I had writer's block before I started writing. 6 months into therapy, and these two things both happened at the same time. I started eating, and I started writing. And it was as if someone had opened up a spring. And the spring has flowed to various degrees of clarity in the years since, but it's never stopped flowing.
Could you put your finger on what it was about therapy that reached you that effectively?
Well, I think it must have been a very strong positive transference at the outset that enabled me to feel secure with someone who was rather fatherly and realize that I was going to be able to deal with all this rage without destroying everybody. Before I wrote my first published novel, another novel appeared, as it were, in one hot week of writing that was about the childhood of a presidential assassin, a Lee Harvey Oswald type. And some of the episodes in that childhood were my own, were autobiographical. I think that emphasizes how much rage children who go through abuse bring to adulthood with them, how much they need help to work their way through that rage usually. Writing itself over the years, I think, has been a very important part of the sort of self-therapy that I've perhaps gone through. And that's certainly one function of writing, but it's enabled me, it's given me a particular perspective, perhaps narrower than I might have liked, had I a choice as a young adult. Perspective on an aspect of human life that people often turn away from, that I very, very intensely prefer not to turn away from, believe must be faced and studied and understood.
You spoke a lot with your brother while writing this book, and you shared memories, and you quote him frequently in your memoir. I'm curious about how the experience shaped your brother differently than you. I mean, as you were saying before, he kind of retreated into the underground labyrinth of the sewers, you know, while you were retreating into books. Can you talk about that a little bit?
To a degree, respecting his privacy.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
My brother, I think, had a difficult adulthood for many years. He went to California, where our oldest brother lives, and eventually came to own a welding shop and to be a very talented craftsman welder who did specialized welding for all sorts of industrial works. But I think always felt somewhat lost and bereft until very recently, when he made a good second marriage and had a wonderful child, a boy who's about 10 now, moved out of L.A. and moved to Idaho to a better environment for his little boy. And one of the nice things about the book, I paid him as a consultant to help me prepare, you know, study our common memories. And with that money, he went back and finished college, which he just graduated last June at the age of 54. I've sensed a wonderful change in him across these last couple of years. I think perhaps this whole business is finally coming to rest for him too, as it has for me. He's happier. He's clearly less depressed. I sense that he feels he has a future.
How did his memories differ from yours? Did you remember things completely differently sometimes?
Oh, sometimes exactly the opposite, and it was frightening to imagine how much one rewrites and distorts. A particular episode when my stepmother was, as I remembered it, just about to hit him with a mop handle that had a large bolt sticking out of it. I was sure, as I remember it, that it was going to, she was going to hit him in the back of the neck and somehow paralyze him. And I remember doing what I did when that sort of thing was happening, standing there and trying to become invisible. I told him that memory when we were talking together, and he looked at me with great surprise and slowly shook his head and said, "No, no, it wasn't me she was hitting, it was you." I completely rewrote that story so that I would be safe from that horrible experience.
On the other hand, maybe you were right.
Maybe he remembers it wrong. Although since Stan is somewhat older, he does have clearer memories of that period than I do, I think.
So you think your memory worked in a way that protected you from what actually happened?
Well, without question. For example, I have no recollection of my father ever spanking me throughout childhood. And when I told Stan that, he said, "Oh, no," he said, "he was a champion spanker. We called him Iron Hand." I have no memory whatsoever. I needed a father who was benevolent and loving and protective, and I wrote him that way.
Is your stepmother still alive?
Yes, she is.
So do you think she knows about the book?
I don't know. She's 91 years old.
Wow.
As I talked to Joan Rivers recently, Joan said, "Oh, God doesn't want her."
So I take it you didn't consult her for her memories on writing this book.
No. My memories are perfectly vivid. There may have been some that were confabulated, but the things that I describe in the book are described as they happened.
Would you ever see her again?
I've had no interest in seeing her since I was 12.
That was the last time you saw her?
That's right.
Was that also the last time you saw your father?
No, I went down to visit the place where he and she had retired right after I graduated from high school, before I went to college, and saw him, did not see her. He was, it seemed to me, a broken shell of a man.
Huh.
So I went on my way. I didn't see him again, even when he died.
Huh. You know, in one respect, you've put the story behind you by having written it. But in another respect, for everybody else, for people who know you only peripherally or as a writer, the story just got told for the first time.
Yes.
So they're just finding it out about you. What kind of reactions don't you want from people? I mean, I suppose you don't want people's sympathy right now.
Oh, well, sympathy perhaps. You know, the book is dedicated to Richard and Stanley. And that's not me and my brother as we are now. It's dedicated to those two little children. One of the experiences one has as a parent when your little children turn into adults is that you no longer have those little children around. It's as if they died. This book is dedicated to those little children, and I hope if people feel sympathy, they'll feel sympathy for them and by extension for the other children.
Richard Rhodes, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Richard Rhodes' new book is A Hole in the World. It's a memoir of his childhood. He also wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning book The Making of the Atomic Bomb. And his book Farm, about a small family farm, is about to come out in paperback. Next time on Fresh Air, journalist Dilip Hero on the Middle East. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the final albums by the late Art Blakey. Also, jazz guitarist Jimmy Rainey tells us how he's continuing to play in spite of an ear disorder that's slowly destroying his hearing. Many Germans rejoiced over the reunification of East and West, but not writer Günter Grass. Book critic John Leonard reviews Grass's new collection of essays opposing one Germany. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of State James Baker called Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the State Department today, following reports the Saudis may be in a compromising mood in the Persian Gulf crisis. The ambassador, Prince Bandar, disputing these reports, said the Saudis were not asking anyone to make concessions. Barry Schweid has more.
The envoy's father, Prince Sultan, is Saudi Arabia's defense minister. According to some reports, Sultan suggested publicly that Kuwait yield some territory to Iraq as part of a settlement of Iraq's occupation of the country. Bandar said the reports were incorrect. He said any territorial decisions are for Kuwait to make and that his government had not urged concessions. To allow Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to benefit from the invasion of Kuwait, Bandar said, would mean applying the law of the jungle. We cannot, he said, make aggression pay. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Israeli Defense Minister Ahrens has ordered the occupied territories completely sealed after a series of revenge attacks by Arabs and Israelis. Under this new government order, the Palestinian residents of the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip will be banned from entering Israel as of Wednesday morning. Those staying in Israel are to return home immediately. In New York City, the UN Security Council has been deadlocked for days on a move to reprimand Israel. But now diplomats are expecting a vote sometime tonight. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
In spite of U.S. efforts to stall a resolution that urges Israel to cooperate with a UN investigation of violence in Jerusalem's Old City, four allies of the PLO are pushing the Security Council to a vote. The vote would be crucial because any serious differences among council members would threaten the solidarity created by the coalition against Iraq. American sources label the new resolution untimely, unbalanced, and unnecessary because Washington still hoped it could pressure Israel to comply with the council's call for an investigation by the end of the month. Diplomats say the United States is expected to either veto or abstain on the resolution. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The Pentagon says that it will be decided in the near future whether or not to send more U.S. troops to the Persian Gulf area. More than 210,000 U.S. troops are now in the Gulf region. A Pentagon spokesman says that General Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, will recommend whether to extend the U.S. buildup when he returns this week from a visit to Saudi Arabia. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 22 points to close at 2,494.06 on volume of some 146 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Drummer Art Blakey was one of the most dedicated and consistently busy band leaders in jazz. He died last week at the age of 71. Blakey was known as a star maker, able to hear the potential in young players and to bring it out of them. He put together the first edition of his Jazz Messengers Band back in the mid-50s. But jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Blakey may have been most influential in his final years.
Years ago, observers speculating about what jazz would be like in the 80s predicted that it'd be a decade in which the balance of power shifted from improvisers to composers. They were wrong. As it turned out, the era belonged to the players, and Art Blakey was the reason why. In 1980, I don't think anyone predicted Blakey would be the dominant influence in jazz. Back then, you could be forgiven for thinking his best years were behind him. He still put together good bands, but they didn't have the impact of earlier units that spawned players like Wayne Shorter, Lee Morgan, Freddie Hubbard, Woody Shaw, Johnny Griffin, Cedar Walton, and lots of other jazz stars. Blakey's revival began in 1980 when he hired an unknown young trumpet player from New Orleans. Art Blakey discovered and nurtured Wynton Marsalis, and Marsalis' own success ushered in the current youth cult in jazz. Once Marsalis struck it rich, big record companies started signing lots of young mainstream jazz musicians. Blakey's band, the Jazz Messengers, was their principal source. The roster of 80s messengers who went on to major label deals includes Branford Marsalis, Terrence Blanchard and Donald Harrison, Benny Green, Kenny Garrett, and Philip Harper of the Harper Brothers. Not to mention alumni who record for smaller labels like Jeff Keezer and Wallace Roney, or now successful late 70s messengers like Bobby Watson and James Williams. In a documentary about Blakey made for British TV a few years ago, Columbia Records jazz honcho George Butler talked about how he always looked to Blakey's band to figure out who to sign next. The cruel irony was that Blakey hadn't recorded for Columbia since 1956. In the 80s, his own records came from independent domestic labels like Concord or from companies overseas. One of two new Messengers albums is on Italy's Soul Note label. It's called I Get a Kick Out of Boo. Boo is Blakey's nickname, short for his Muslim name, Abdullah ibn Buhayna. Art Blakey's albums are like his live performances. Even when they're not great, they're good. I Get a Kick Out of Boo, which was recorded 2 years ago, is a good album. It includes the usual hard bop swingers and ballad features for individual players like trombonist Robin Eubanks, or this one, trumpeter Philip Harper. Blakey's other new album is his first for a major American label in ages. One for All is on the A&M label. Recorded 6 months ago, it features the last edition of the Messengers, which included saxophonist Javon Jackson and Dale Barlow, pianist Jeff Keezer, and bassist Essiet Essiet. It's another good album, a reminder of the lessons Blakey taught his young charges, like how to build a solo to an emotional climax and then quickly pull back and cut out. Here's trumpeter Brian Lynch on Nika's Tempo. Listen to the way Blakey applies pressure with his drums without getting in Lynch's way. At the heart of what Blakey taught young musicians was his unsentimental yet romantic notion that the stage and the studio are tough places to make a living. He worked his bands hard, demanded their loyalty, and didn't exactly spoil them by paying out too much money. Now that Art Blakey's gone, it'll be interesting to see which New York band leader slips into his role as a developer of new talent. There will surely be a few contenders. But the one who succeeds best will probably be someone like Art Blakey himself, who believed there was nothing as valuable to a young musician as playing before the public six nights a week. Art Blakey died knowing that a lot of his messengers had gotten his message, and that they'll continue to spread it to younger players they work with. The head messenger is dead, but the message has a life of its own.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Art Blakey's new albums are I Get a Kick Out of Boo on the Soul Note label and One for All on A&M. This is Fresh Air. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Louisville helping station WFPL celebrate its 40th anniversary. While I was there, I took advantage of hearing a great musician who had returned to his hometown of Louisville over 20 years ago, guitarist Jimmy Rainey. Rainey's early reputation was based on being one of the first musicians to translate Charlie Parker's bebop innovations to guitar. But Rainey's importance goes beyond that to his subtle touch and melodic lines. The day I heard him, he was playing solo at a restaurant. He sounded great, and it was a good day for him. He could hear what he was playing. Rainey has a progressive ear disorder called Meniere's disease. He's completely lost the hearing in one ear. Rainey left Louisville in the 40s to go on the road. He played with Stan Getz and Woody Herman's band. Then in the early 50s, he recorded a series of records with Getz that have just been reissued on Mosaic Records. Tell me why you returned to Louisville.
Honestly?
Yeah.
I was drinking like a fish, and I split up with my wife, and I didn't know what to do. And I couldn't handle New York and nothing. I couldn't work. And my mother needed some help, assistance and everything. So I came down temporarily, and I stayed.
You've been having ear problems for years. Meniere's disease. What are the symptoms of it? What are your symptoms?
Well, there's a loss of hearing, and then there's what it is too much fluid in the inner ear, and it doesn't drain off, and it distorts and destroys the nerves of the inner ear, which are the hairs that run to the nerve ends that run to the brain. You know. And it damages them and eventually destroys them. But and that's it's intermittent, and which defies any kind of trial and error method of drugs, you know, because is it the drug or did it just go away by itself, get better by itself?
So how does this affect how you play and when you can play?
Well, that's why I'm playing solo. I haven't played in New York for several years, or Europe, or why I haven't made any records too, because it's been so bad the last couple of years. This is the best time I've had in 2 years, the longest good spell. The trick is I can play solo even when I can't hear it, when it sounds wrong, because it does something else that's not mentioned in any of the medical books. It makes you tone deaf.
So what does that mean? You can hear sound, but you can't differentiate the tone?
I can't tell the notes. I sometimes can't tell the instruments. I can't tell if it's really bad. I can't tell whether they're playing rock or Mozart or jazz. I can only tell it's organized sound rather than noise.
Huh. So on those days when you're not hearing well, but you can still play solo, you're just playing what you hear in your head anyways?
Yeah, and also the brain plays a funny trick. I can play, and I know what I'm playing, and I hear it, so it makes up, the brain makes the noise I'm making sound like what I'm playing to me.
Right.
But if somebody else starts to play, I can't tell what they're playing because I don't know it beforehand.
Was it difficult for you to accept what was happening to you, or were you able to accept
Yeah,
that?
It's okay. I'm prepared to be totally deaf, unless I die first or something, but it's okay.
On the days when your hearing's good, do you ever go back to listen to your own records?
Not so much. I don't want to sound modest, but when my ears are working, there's other things I'd rather hear than myself. But sometimes I'll play something that I really haven't listened to for a long time. Like, I haven't listened. I did an album in '76 called Live in Tokyo, which was actually pretty good for me because it was live and it was good engineers and it was a good hall in Tokyo. So I listened to a couple of those the other day. It was okay.
First guitarist to take, you know, the modern jazz sound, the bop sound, and incorporate that onto guitar. Was it particularly challenging to do that on guitar?
Well, technically it was a little bit, because Tal and I arrived at a similar solution independently.
Tal Farlow.
Mm-hmm. And he said in public, and I've said it too, well, we're both trying to play like Charlie Parker and Bud Powell, and it's that's the way it came out. Well, that's true. I mean, my ambitions at that point were no more than to be a Charlie Parker, Bud Powell interpreter. I mean, when I was that age, because that was hard enough, God knows. If I could really play good bebop that was really correct the way they did it, I would have been, that was more than, that was a high ambition, for, you know, and I happened to play guitar. And I got a good reputation out of that because no one else did it on guitar, with the exception of Tal, and to a certain degree, Chuck Wayne. But and then I made all those records with Stan right at that time, so that did it. I think after that I became my own man in a way, more.
You didn't become an orthodox bopper. I mean, and you really... I think you really have an affection for song form and melody. Do you know what I mean? Not just harmonics of Bob.
But I never tried to be original, too. That's another thing. I tried to be better all my life. My only grail was in the sense of a quest, was the search for quality. I'm not saying that I have it, but that's my quest was, not originality. I figure originality would come if you're good enough. And if it didn't, at least you would be good at what you were doing. Better that than some mechanical, contrived style. Because that's easy enough to cook up a different style.
You lost your hearing in one ear, and you've been having the intermittent problems with the other ear. Right. Has it changed your playing or your composing? You know, do you think that there's something different that you're going for in your music because of your hearing?
I've thought about that, actually, but I'm not sure I've come to any conclusion, except I think it forces you to hear what you play before much more clearly. And I think, as a consequence, if anything, my playing is more precise. the thing, that's a good point. The debit side is when you're improvising, you can spiral up into a place where you don't know exactly what you're doing, but you're carrying, depending on your ear, the musical ear, and also what you're hearing to pull you out of it. One idea suggests another and so on. Some of that is lost because you're less likely to take chances, you know, because if I hit a wrong note, I'll hear the one I thought I hit, not the one that I actually hit. And that makes you worry a little bit and watch your fingers a little more, you know, and stuff like that.
On those days when you don't hear well or you don't hear at all and you're playing, mm-hmm. And you're hearing it in your mind before you play, so you know what you're playing, does the audience know?
Not unless I tell them.
Do you tell them?
Well, I don't ordinarily make announcements.
Right.
Uh-huh. So, I played a year with Scott Henderson, and he just followed me, you know. He knew. And I said, how's your ears? Awful. You know, and okay, then if anything went wrong, like where I slipped off, you know, without rhythm, there's a problem of synchronizing your playing, because he may be playing some single notes and some chords, and I'm playing a solo, and I might not be sure what the rhythm is. We might slip apart. There's not much meter problem. That's in your head. That keeps going on. But you can slip apart by the night. So I'd be sure you synchronize with me. He knew my playing well enough that he knew from the notes I was playing exactly where I was if he had any doubt, you know. So we did that for a year. It was no problem. But when I'm hearing, it's a pleasure. And when I'm not, it's kind of imaginary. And sometimes it's unpleasant.
Why unpleasant?
Well, because it sounds so funny, you know. And if I'm hearing, like, as I explained to you before, if Scott is playing, I don't know what he's playing.
Yeah.
If I'm playing, it sounds like pretty much like a slightly blurred version of what I'm playing. But I could make a tape of myself and turn it on in the middle. I don't know what it is.
Well, I'm really glad I got to hear you play today. I enjoyed it immensely.
I didn't know you were coming.
Yeah. thanks very much for doing the interview.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was my pleasure also.
Guitarist Jimmy Rainey. Special thanks to John Gregory of Station WFPL in Louisville, where we recorded this interview. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have news today from Jackie Lydon reporting on the release of some American hostages from Iraq. Also, news of several trials. The Metzger trial, the American Nazi leader who agreed to pay a large settlement. Also, revisiting the notorious Boston murder case, the Stewart case, 1 year later. And we'll talk with jurors from the Mapplethorpe and Two Live Crew trials, together with Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard Law professor, about how you come to a verdict about a case in which art is put on trial.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Politics have always figured in the fiction and essays of German writer Günter Grass. His books include The Tin Drum, Cat and Mouse, and The Flounder. Now there's a new collection of his writing on the subject of German reunification. The title poses the question, Two States, One Nation? Book critic John Leonard has a review.
They went ahead and did it anyway, the two Germanys, as if the Berlin Wall had been a chastity belt. They're in bed together again, a single two-backed beast, under the sign of the Deutschmark, in spite of Günter Grass, who told them not to. Grass has been telling them not to for 30 years. He agrees with the Frenchman who said he loved Germany so much that he was glad there were two of them, which is why Grass has been called, and I quote, a traitor to the fatherland. The bad boy of German letters hates the very idea of a German fatherland. Look what the fatherland does when the lights are out all over Europe. This is more than Oedipal rage, as Grass makes clear in these essays and speeches dating back to 1961. He began to write because of Auschwitz. Writing after Auschwitz meant using damaged language in all the shades of gray, No more black-and-white ideology, or blues of introspection, or polished literary chamber music. No more detergents and all-purpose poetry, but shame on every white page. Maybe some other nation could have committed Auschwitz, but only one really did. Unless, says Grass, we stuffed our ears with lottery tickets, we must have heard the screaming. One of the preconditions, he says, for the terrible thing that happened was a strong, unified Germany. We have every reason to fear ourselves as a unit. He calls instead for a confederation, a linkage of provinces, sort of like Switzerland. Germany in the singular is a calculation that will never balance, he says. As a sum, it is a communicating plural. This plural can communicate in a mother tongue instead of a fatherland, a state of mind, a muscular culture, as German language writers communicated long before Bismarck, as far back as Grimmelshausen in the 17th century, and as recently as Group 47 after Hitler's war. These writers never killed anybody. Two states, one nation, will get some silly reviews. The New York Times has already said that when it comes to politics, Grass is kind of dopey. Let's see how dopey he sounds a year from now when half the population of what used to be East Germany is unemployed. And he's speaking in metaphors, anyway. You and I may feel that the war is over. Let bygones be bygones. No hard feelings. Some of our best friends are Germans. But Grass understands himself to be, quote, someone who writes against passing time. Time passes, but Auschwitz hasn't gone away. What's wrong with us, he wrote in Headbirths, is neither material nor social, but an emergency of the spirit. In his opinion, nationalism, everywhere and anywhere, is a bacillus. He quotes here from a fairy tale in his novel Dog Years. Nothing is pure, he says, not snow, nor virgins, nor salt, nor Jesus Christ, nor Karl Marx. If anything were pure, then, quote, the bones, white mounds that were recently heaped up, would grow immaculately without crows, pyramids of glory. But the crows, which are not pure, were creaking unoiled even yesterday. Nothing is pure, no circle, no bone, and piles of bones, heaped up for the sake of purity, will melt, cook, boil, in order that soap, pure and cheap. But even soap cannot wash pure. To this shameful fatherland of the white mounds and the cheap soap, Günter Grass is a Cassandra, a pariah, a brave traitor, and a brilliant witness.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Two States, One Nation by Günter Grass. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Journalist Dilip Hero has written books on Islamic fundamentalism and the Iran-Iraq War. On the next Fresh Air, we discuss the roots of the Gulf crisis. Also, Charles Burnett talks with us about his new film, To Sleep With Anger, starring Danny Glover. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
A new season of free 91FM community concerts begins this Sunday evening at the Church of the Savior, 38th and Chestnut in Philadelphia. The Lenape Chamber Ensemble with pianist Mark Antonio Barone plays Mozart's E-flat piano quartet, Prokofiev's Sonata for Two Violins, and the piano quintet in C minor by Ernst von Dohnányi. At a reception after the concert, meet the musicians and members of the 91FM staff. Call 215-351-9200 during business hours for more information. Don't miss this free 91FM community concert Sunday evening at 7:30 at the Church of the Savior in University City. This concert is made possible by grants from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the Henry G. Keasby Fund of the Philadelphia Foundation.
It's 8 o'clock on 91FM. Good evening, my name is Melinda Whiting, and...